Welcome to Pod of Orcas. I'm Justin Cox. Today, we have a familiar friend joining us on the podcast to talk about a whale so rare that even the foremost experts on them are lucky to see them once or twice in their lifetime. My guest is Kevin Campion, who helped in the creation of season one of this podcast and appeared in the introductions for all of those episodes about southern resident killer whales that we did. Today, we're going to talk about the North Pacific right whale. Kevin and his crew made an excellent new film called Right Over the Edge, all about their search for this elusive and severely endangered species, which used to number in the tens of thousands in the North Pacific and is now down to a population of about 30. That's right, 30. I'm not a scientist, so I'm only speaking right now as a 21st century human with a mild addiction to my iPhone. Whenever I learn that we simply don't know where a species goes for months at a time, it kind of mystifies me. It's counterintuitive to everything that we kind of hear about the world now. We're so wired to believe that everything can be easily tracked, from smartphones to thousands of commercial airlines all over the globe. But of course, these are marine mammals. These are animals, you know. But there's something magical and mysterious about simply not knowing where they go, as much as the desire to know is driven by a desire to protect, and that's what you're going to hear about in this movie. Take that mystery and put a group of friends on a 90-year-old wooden boat setting sail in search of a remnant population of a species of whale that weighs 200,000 pounds, and you kind of get that kind of sets the scene for this movie. Kevin Campion is the founder of Deep Green Wilderness and a board member with the Sea Dog Society. We talk a bit about those two things early in this conversation before diving headlong into his search for the North Pacific right whale. The Sea Dog Society will be hosting a free screening of Right Over the Edge on Orcas Island on the evening of Thursday, May 18th at the Seaview Theater. Put that on your calendar and please come out and join us. That event marks the in-person return of our popular Ocean Night series, which we're very excited about. Kevin also has screenings planned for San Juan Island and Everett, so you'll hear about those in this conversation. Make sure to get Sea Dog Society's free newsletter at seadogsociety.org/newsletter. There's a link in the episode notes. And you'll stay in the know on all things Salish Sea science and conservation. We're also on all of the main social media apps under the handle Sea Dog Society, SEADOC Society. Here's my conversation with Kevin Campion. Kevin Campion, welcome to Pod Orcas. How you doing?
I'm doing very good, and I'm quite happy to be back on Pod of Orcas.
Lovely to be talking to you on this podcast. It's a familiar and comfortable place.
I was reflecting this morning, well, just a minute ago, right before we started, I'm like, I got to get my podcast voice going here. No, it's really cool to see what you've done in the second season, and I was just very stoked on where it's gone, and it's been fun, and I've quite love the theme of hope that's coming out.
Yeah. I appreciate that. And there would have been no second season if not for that first season being something that kind of turned out so cool and was received so well. So loved doing that with you. I introduced you in the intro here, but you're a member of the Sea Doc board and have been for a while. When did you join the Sea Doc Society board, and how did that kind of come to be? Just to kind of like, we don't need to go super deep into that, but just to get to know your connection with this organization.
Yeah. So I have been on the Sea Doc board for the better part of a decade, and I don't know the actual date, but it feels like a while now, like pleasantly so. Personally, it's allowed for a whole lot of growth and learning that's felt really good. But my stepmom, Sonia, was helped out in the very initial setting up of Sea Doc. And so I was always aware of Sea Doc Society and somewhat aware of the work they were doing. And then I worked on Orcas Island for a few years directly across West Sound, so I could kind of see the Sea Doc office, though I didn't really know what I was looking at the time. So I met Joe, who had me over for a tour of the office, and it just kind of went from there. And I've always had a real passionate interest in ocean health, and conservation and marine science. And so it just felt like a pretty natural fit, other than, like I said, I felt like way over my head when I first joined, but my interests and somewhat of a skill set that I brought were pretty aligned with Sea Doc.
If you said the better part of a decade, how does that timing line up with Deep Green Wilderness? When did that launch? That's a little bit similar, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So Deep Green Wilderness started in 2009. We had our first students on board in 2010. And so similar vibe of like, oh my, what am I doing? This is like, I'm very much treading water. And then to kind of figuring out a rhythm to the thing to where now I feel like we've always run effective programs, but we're much better now at what we're doing. And I just understand how the work goes a lot better, but it feels nice kind of to be at that place in both these things, CDOC and Deep Green Wilderness, which is maybe why I felt comfortable enough to like launch Save the North Pacific Right Whale and this whole the film and everything around it.
Yeah, I want to go from Deep Green Wilderness to that. Is it coincidental that around that time, 2009, 2010, like this time period that you ended up launching Deep Green Wilderness and these tours and marine education and everything? I mean, that's some direct involvement and action in trying to be a part of something or changing something. Is it a time that you look back on as like that you got involved in that way, or is it just the way things lined up?
I've never reflected on it in that way. It is in large part just the way things lined up. But also when I started Deep Green Wilderness, I'd been working for other similar organizations for quite a while. And when I started my own thing, I was really allowed to focus. I focused on whatever I wanted. And I wanted to focus on marine conservation and connecting students with marine conservation and marine science. And so I was able to kind of like fly my marine conservation flag a lot higher than I had been able to at other jobs. And so I think when I then was connecting with CDOC, I was able to speak from this place of like, yeah, this is what my life means. And I kind of understood that and had taken a step into like just living that a lot more holistically, for lack of a better or less cheesy word. But so when I was approached by CDOC, it was like, oh yeah, of course, this is a very natural fit for sure. Yeah. And I certainly my time on the CDOC board, or more just my relationship with CDOC, with you and Joe and Kirsten, has really informed the work at Deep Green Wilderness in like how I think about this place and how we teach about it and learn about it. You know, CDOC does a whole lot of learning about the Salish Sea. That's like one of the reasons CDOC exists, right? I asked Joe to come talk to our students, and then our students are like, holy cow, I could be a wildlife veterinarian. That's awesome. And then they, it changes the course of their education or career arc. And so the whole thing's, there's a real fuzzy line where the two things connect, and it's like all the electrons or whatever charge positive on both sides of that interface. And it feels awesome. Like it's really cool when the two things do connect.
If people working in this area were just a bunch of like disparate individual organizations doing their one individual thing, you don't really move anything in a direction that way. You kind of have to have them working together and energizing each other. And I think it's really cool. I gave the basics of it in the introduction, but what do you do at Deep Green Wilderness?
Yeah. So Orion 89, she'd take offense to the 100, I think. Yeah. We take students, which are mostly middle and high school age students, voyaging from a day to a month. And mostly what we do are like week, 2 week or 3 week long trips. And they are interdisciplinary in that the students are like learning to sail and navigate and what it means to like live on a boat while you're working that boat. They learn marine conservation through the lens mostly of whales and whale research and what is current with whales. One of the coolest things over the life of Deep Green Wilderness has been, and we've been on the water, has been when humpbacks have showed up to the Salish Sea. So I can remember it was a couple years into to Deep Green Wilderness that we saw the first humpback. I was off Jones Island. It was right by Jim and Laura Donald's place. We saw our first humpback off Orcas or north of Jones. And it was just like the coolest thing ever to like be on the water showing students this humpback whale that a year ago wouldn't have been there because we just have humpbacks in the Salish Sea. So back to Deep Green Wilderness, the students do their own either research or art project while they're out there. Deep Green Wilderness is really a way to just connect students with the ocean and with the natural world in a way that allows them to like think deeply about what that connection is. And it turns out that a sailboat and an old wooden sailboat especially is a really good way to foster that connection and foster a community of like-minded connections and folks. And so we'll be on the water for a day to a month where the students are learning about this place through seeing whales and doing research on those whales or sketching about those whales. But then the person sitting next to them, who's also responsible for making lunch for them, who they'll be responsible for making lunch for tomorrow, is also learning about the whales because they want to write a song about them. We have a bunch of cool teenagers that don't know each other. Yeah. They're thrown onto a sailboat for a month and it like maybe could sound like a reality TV show, but it's quite the opposite where like there's not a lot of drama. It's just a lot of like community building and support that happens. And the sailboat's a great way to nurture that. I think we could put them on a bus to drive to Wyoming or something. And the same, they'd come out being friends in a slightly different way, but people tend to gravitate towards each other in those situations. But the sailboat, you can really, you know, through teaching sailing and reliance on each other and your shipmates, there's just like an awesome lesson.
The amount that you must learn about yourself and about the world and about other people from being just on a boat out there, and you're on a sailboat. So I'm sure there's a job to be done at all times for people. There are things it needs to be tended to. And like you said, you're working on a project, you're observing the world, you're interacting with people, you're handling meals. Sounds amazing. And it actually is a good transition to the film because that's young people and students going out to embark on this really awesome educational experience. But I mean, your film is about North Pacific right whale. It's about about whales. It's about nature and the environment, but it's heavily, heavily carried by people on a boat together, right? There's a lot of these, you're out searching. And I mean, the movie is funny, sad, inspiring. It's kind of all these things, but it's a lot of searching, right?
Yeah. So the film is called Right Over the Edge, The Search for the North Pacific Right Whale. And so we were searching, and the North Pacific right whale is, we call it the rarest whale in the world. It is one of the rarest whales in the world. There's a handful of populations around the world that are just these crazy remnant populations, and North Pacific right whales are one of them.
And when we say remnant population, how much are we estimating?
Off our coast, off the North American coast, there's about 30 North Pacific right whales where there should have been 20,000. So and that's one genetically distinct population. And then off the coast of Russia, Japan, Korea, there's another population that estimates are from 200 to 500, which is very inaccurate number, right? There's 300 whales, a discrepancy in there, but those two populations don't really interact genetically as far as we know. But when I say as far as we know about North Pacific right whales, we don't know. We don't know anything about these whales except for a handful of places they go and what they do when they're there.
Before you continue on, when you say there should be around 20,000 of them, why is there not? What's the story there?
The same reason we know how many there should be is all data from whaling records. And the reason there are not North Pacific right whales in more abundance is from historic whaling. A wave of whaling that happened starting in the 1840s, and then a second wave that happened starting in the 50s from actually the Soviets. And so that first wave, which this is like, think Moby Dick, very similar technology. He talks about right whales in Moby Dick. Sail whaling mostly from the East Coast of America, Massachusetts, all those, exactly what you think of when you think of like stereotypical old timey whaling.
I can picture it.
Oh yeah. That whole fleet almost worldwide was in the North Pacific in the 1840s. And They killed between 20 and 30,000 right whales in about a 10-year span. And we know that because they kept pretty detailed records of, because they wanted to know when they came back the next year, like, where do we find whales? How many whales were there? How many were we able to kill? Yeah. And on and on. And so there's great records of that just show this catastrophic decline in the population. To over the course of, let's say, 30, 40 years, they became what we call commercially extinct, where it's no longer profitable to go look for them, to kill them. They're still alive and in the North Pacific, but they're so scarce that it takes too long to find one. So it's not economically viable to
do. I think the what you all are doing in this film demonstrates that. Just for anyone who doesn't know, why are they being killed at this level, and what's happening with them? Where are they being taken? What are these people doing with the whales that they're killing?
In that time, whales, the big whales that were targeted were mostly sperm whales and right whales. And that was, right whales was for their blubber, which is, you just render into oil, and whale oil provided a lot of things that we use petroleum products for now, fuel, lubricants, like a lot of lighting that, you know, this is pre-electricity even. And so they would use whale oil for lighting and candle making. And then the baleen, which they use to catch copepods to feed, that also is like, has a real plastic type quality. And so they would use it for things that we would probably use plastic for now. Like the typical one that's quoted is buggy whips and corsets, which is always like, they use it for a lot of other things too. But that, like, when you say buggy whips and corsets, my mind just goes right to that time. And you're like, oh yeah, I can really picture these guys coming home with their buggy whip and corset supplies. But that is though, that is why they killed them all, mostly for the oil and the baleen. You would leave from New Bedford, you'd sail around Cape Horn, say like real nonchalantly, you just sail around Cape Horn, take a right, and then head up. And you'd be gone basically until your ship was full. And so primarily it's filling up with barrels of oil. And the processing would happen mostly back in those ports on the East Coast. And San Francisco, as it came of age, they would start to take stuff in San Francisco. And I forget what year the train connected, but at some point I think they're even training stuff back to the East Coast. But it's interesting to me how all this like intersects with American history in a way that I had never thought about, just how conservation of these things I love, whales, has this like 200 year long thread that goes back through all that, like takes me right into the pages of like this very general American history that we learned, you know, in high school and junior high.
So you talked about Deep Green Wilderness, talked about the Orion, you've talked about your time out on the water, and you're a curious person. And I've walked around with you. I've walked around with you and heard like bird sounds, and you just like know exactly what bird is in a tree near you, and you're very attuned to your surroundings and nature. I feel like, how does this work you're doing in the field and this interest in all of these things evolve into a film about the North Pacific right whale? How does this kind of thing take shape?
Yeah. I'm going to think, I have like an immediate answer, but I do love birds a lot. This time of year is really fun because each day you get like a new bird that you haven't seen in 6 months. I woke up this morning to orange crowned warbler, which is that's like, to me, like really a punctuation on the start of spring when those guys show up and start singing.
I'm jealous of what you have in that. I don't have the skill set to be able to do that, but I love being around it.
Just a lifetime of interest and my folks and all that.
A fun little story is one time I was driving back from Vancouver in with Joe Gatos, and he had like his iPod or whatever on shuffle, and every so often between the songs, you just get like some bird sounds and then the name of the bird and then the bird sound again, and then it goes to a song. So you just got like bird sounds interspersed within what plays on his iPod. fun.
That's awesome. I have the same, but it's never come up in like an embarrassing way, thankfully.
Don't you dare be embarrassed about that. That's cool.
So I learned about North Pacific right whales through this sighting that happened in at Swiftsure Bank, which is the entrance to the Salish Sea, the west entrance to the Salish Sea. It's this, people probably get sick of hearing me talk about it, but it is just this very cool spot that is very rich habitat for all sorts of marine life. And it's like the front door to the Salish Sea. And in 2013, a North Pacific right whale was found there by this guy named Brian Gisborne, who I didn't know about at the time, didn't know about Brian. I also didn't know about North Pacific right whales. And I just have this intense interest and love for this place, the Salish Sea, where I grew up and run my programs. And like, I can't talk enough about how awesome this place is and how deeply I care for it. And I would say the exact same thing about whales. I love whales. My walls when I was a little kid had like skateboard posters and whale posters. And like my walls now have skateboard posters. Like you can see the whale behind me. Yeah. Like if I flip the camera around, you'd see skateboards. But like I've always just loved whales, and I read about them, I learn about them, I enjoy that. And I had never heard about this whale called the North Pacific right whale. I knew about the other species of right whales. I didn't know we had right whales off our coast. And this is a whale that you could leave from Orcas Island and be out there in like a really long day of traveling on the boat. So it's like in my sphere or you know, radius of where I work, and here is this whale that I didn't even know existed the day before I read about it. And that to me, that just was like, I don't know why that struck such a chord in me, but it did, to where I became really curious about it. And this is a time when I maximized some SeaDoc relationships, where I was like, people that I'd met through SeaDoc that were doing whale research, I'd email them, or if I bumped into them at something, I'd ask them about North Pacific right whales. And most of the people I talked to also didn't know that there were right whales in the North Pacific. Wow. And these are like humpback researchers or orca researchers. And that, like, the chord that had been struck just started resonating even louder when I learned that. And I had started to get a sense of like the underdog story that North Pacific right whales have. And I think one of the things that, you know, you talk about me being good at like observing, like, okay, yeah, I heard the orange crown warbler, but before I was even out of bed this morning, so what got me out of bed this morning was awesome. If you and I are walking, or like if we're walking on the sidewalk and I'm like, oh, orange crown warbler, like that just shows off that I can hear orange crown warbler, but it doesn't mean much to you unless I'm like, oh dude, check it out, I have my binocs, let's look at it. And then you get to see it and you're like, why is it called the orange crown warbler? Well, you can't see the orange crown. Well, oh, you only get to see that on real rare occasions. And so if this like interest I have and like a skill set I have for observing nature doesn't do much unless you learn how to spin that into a story that interests the next person in it.
Cool.
That's something that I'm also good at that I've really developed in working on the boat. And it's how to like a middle school kid who like doesn't care or just doesn't know they care about this, whatever, a surf scoter. Like you show them the surf scoter and then you build the story around them, that the scoter, and that person like, oh yeah, that is cool. Like, oh, I'm going to tell my buddy about that. Whatever the thing is. And so I think that storytelling is something that I'm good at. And as an organization, we're really good at. And I'm not good at doing research and having the patience to collect long-term data and process that data in a way that also tells a story or like gets at this thing about something in nature, which is also desperately needed. But North Pacific right whales have these huge data gaps that we can talk about. But I am good at learning about something, finding our place in that, and then creating a story from that.
The way we've talked about that within SeaDoc Society is like the idea of in order to protect something, you need to first of all know that it even exists and then connect with it in some way. And that's kind of what you're describing. It's like, hey, look, orange crown warbler. Here's why they're cool. Here's their situation. Same thing. North Pacific right whale. Oh, you work with whales in the Pacific Northwest and literally don't know that this whale exists. Like, yeah, there's a story to be told there for sure. A tide pooler knows that beneath every barnacle-covered rock rests a potential world of wonder. In the tide pools, the land and the sea become one, a natural playground for the curious and the adventurous. Whether you're exploring the beaches of Orcas Island, walking the bustling streets of Seattle, or far from the Salish Sea, your care for the planet is as constant as the ebbing and flowing tides. You can join today by simply making a monthly donation to the Sea Doc Society in any amount, and you'll get exclusive field updates and an invitation to a special tide pooling event with our staff on Orcas Island this summer, with a casual social gathering to follow. You'll also be directly supporting the creation of this here podcast. Let's pool together to turn the tides for the Salish Sea. Become a tide pooler at seadocsociety.org/donate.
Yeah, totally. And you ask about like the search component of the story or of the film. That is like, we're like, okay, we're going to go look for this thing that's one of the rarest mammals in the world, one of the rarest animals in the world. And we're going to take the viewer along with us, and we don't know how it's going to end. I'm not going to say how it ends because I want people to see the film, but we don't know how it's going to end. Like, we know it's going to be really hard to find this animal. And we have some things that are in our favor. Most things are not in our favor to find it. And we know that regardless of the outcome, if we find the whale or not, we're going to have a pretty good time out there and see a bunch of really cool things. Like, we got to sail around Vancouver Island, which had been a long time dream of mine. We saw all sorts of, it's just a very cool part of the ocean and a cool part of the land when we got to be on it. And we saw albatross and shearwaters, all these cool birds, tons of whales, all just like, and I was with like my best friends. And so it was a lot of work, but we had this voyage and approached it in a way that the viewer, the audience was along with us. And we were very conscious of that. You know, we're out there having fun with like our friend group, but very aware that fun and that voyage we were having was like that was the film and the story. And so
people who watch this movie will fall in love with the crew and the like energy on the boat, and sort of like, it does a really good job of placing you on the boat with people who are like, I mean, I think there's a certain thing that probably happens in your mind and in your heart when you're out in the middle of the ocean looking for something for days on end. Like, I can't pretend to know what that is, but it's really, that's why I say at the beginning that it's like both at times sad and everything, but also it's carried by these people on this boat who you come to really, really love and enjoy for all their various different like personalities and journeys, and it's really cool.
Well, I thank you for saying that, and I'm glad that does stand out to you. And I don't think, no one on board is like an exceptional human to be out doing this work, but we just happen to be really good friends, all from, we've all worked together doing these education programs, and like being at sea with someone with the stress of having teenagers on board is like a pretty awesome bonding experience that makes, if you don't have a sense of humor and a sense of camaraderie, you don't last. And so, and everyone that was on board, we've all worked together for a long time on this boat. And so we were just really happy to have that time together. And, you know, there's also like, there's a very family quality to it where we would, you know, fight over the work or bicker, but you don't see on film, but like, I do hope that friendship is visible to the audience and resonates with the audience. So we sail around Vancouver Island, and then we also get to sail on a different boat in the Bering Sea, which until about like maybe 6 weeks before we left, felt like an absolute fantasy to me. Like, we didn't think it was going to happen. And then Lindsay, who's in the film, like really had a stroke of logistic genius and put it all together. And then you're kind of with that same crew of people, like having this even larger adventure. And looking back on it now, like I can't even believe we got to do that. It sounds so awesome to be able to have that experience and have this purpose behind it, which is to find this whale and tell the story, which has like finding the whale doesn't have a lot of meaning, but telling the story of the whale has a really deep meaning for the whale, where one of the biggest conservation needs that these whales have is that people just need to know they exist. And so knowing that we're out there with that as the end goal, it was great. It was just like, I recommend everyone go look for a right whale in the Bering Sea. It's a great life experience.
I love it. I'm gonna have you talk about where people can find more about the film in a minute. But I'll say, as we go to that, on the website, you can meet the crew there. And then in the movie, you can really meet the crew. What are your plans for screening the film in the Pacific Northwest and any other ways people can go about finding it and learning about this whale?
We are currently in the enter it into film festival stage. So we just yesterday got accepted into Wildlife Without Borders Film Festival. I don't know much about it, but we got accepted, which we're excited. I texted Shaughnessy and Lindsay the good news, and it auto-corrected. This lets you know where my phone is at. Auto-corrected to Wildlife Without Birders. So there was some confusion. But yeah, we're entering it into film festivals, and then we're trying to get as many screenings as possible in the immediate term, which will be Orcas Island on the 18th, right?
May 18th, yeah.
May 18th on Orcas Island, May 20th in Friday Harbor on San Juan Island, and then May 31st at Everett Community College. A couple other film festivals, one in Dana Point we'll be at on the first Sunday in May. I should have the date in front of me, but the two things are kind of happening. One, we're trying to just get attention to through the film festival circuit, which is just the traditional how you get a film into the world. You do film festivals, and then hopefully get the attention of someone that can help you with distribution. And you know, we want this thing to be seen as widely as possible, and getting a distribution deal is the way you do that. But then also we, as an organization, Save the North Pacific Right Whale is involved in this petition to increase critical habitat in the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea for North Pacific right whales. And there's a comment period that will open up any day. They're a little over a month late to respond to the petition. As soon as they respond, a 90-day comment period opens up. And so we've been trying to generate postcards and comments through screenings. I have a goal of 1,000 postcards that I want to get. We're at like 150 or something like right now that just says, hey, right whales are important. Increasing their critical habitat is important.
Cool.
So we're scrambling to do that right now, knowing that I take off on the boat in a couple of weeks and I'm not going to have much time to put towards that when the comment period is actually open.
Well, we will have links to all those screenings in the description for this episode and a link to that comment period and where you can go to comment on that when that opens up. But that's awesome. So we got three opportunities to screen the movie in the coming month or month and a half in the Pacific Northwest. That's great.
Yeah, and it'll eventually live online somewhere, and whether it's behind a paywall or not, I'm unsure. One of the things that I try and remind myself is that these whales can live for 100 years, and so an extra 6 months is, they need action yesterday on their conservation, but another 6 months is not going to break the bank for them, I don't think. And so I'm just trying to be patient with the process and not burn myself out and force everything.
You'll drive yourself insane if you're not patient with the process on these kinds of things.
Oh, very much.
It's a movie, you know. Yeah. Anything it feels like that I haven't asked you about it? Did you want people to know about the film or anything else?
I'll maybe talk just briefly about Save the North Pacific Right Whale, because the website's pretty cool to check out if you're interested in these whales. And
do it.
It was really important to us in making the film that the film had a plan attached to it, how we were going to improve life or improve outcomes for North Pacific right whales with the film. So it wasn't going to be a thing that you just saw and enjoyed. It was going to be a thing you saw, enjoyed, felt inspired to take action, and then took some action that helped North Pacific right whales. And so as part of that, we started this organization called Save the North Pacific Right Whale. The mission is in the name. We're trying to save the North Pacific right whale. And it's the only conservation group that's focused specifically on North Pacific right whales. There are a couple other conservation groups that have done some great work with them in the past. The website for Save the North Pacific Right Whale is northpacificrightwhale.org. And it's just like a library of information about North Pacific right whales. It also says what we're doing and connects you to the film's website. But it is a place where if you want to learn about North Pacific right whales, you can do that in a pretty effective way. And one of the coolest parts of it that I'm most proud of is this work that Kate Ruby's done for us, making a map of all the sightings from the last 30 years.
Cool.
Which these whales are so rare that if they have a sighting, there's a paper that gets published from it almost every time. And so on the map, you can just hover over the whale icon and it'll link you to the data about that sighting or the paper that was published about it. So it's a really cool way. For me, it's like a hopeful image because you see the North Pacific and you see that there's actually whales in it, which you don't always when you're researching or learning about these animals. But two, it's a really cool way to like, just I think it's a great science communication tool that is fully Kate's work. That's just, it's an awesome way to learn about an animal.
That's so cool. That what you just said about having a map to like, say like, look, these sightings are there. Like that's a good thing to keep you moving forward and keep energy going. Cause like in the movie, you're literally meeting people and talking to people that are like, I saw the movie like probably a year ago. So a screening and an early version of it. So I don't have like exact super, super fresh memories, but it's like, this guy is a legend. He's seen the right whale, the North Pacific right whale twice or something like that. It's like, we're talking people who this kind of like area and this area of work is their world. And this is how rare this whale is.
Exactly. Like one other thing I'll add for some content and context. We did a screening last week that included a lecture from Dana Wright, who W-R, not R, Wright, who has been researching North Pacific right whales for a decade and has never seen one. And she is does mostly acoustic stuff. Her research is helping us inform this petition for the critical habitat because she's found that these whales are in places we didn't know they were all through acoustics. But she's been studying these whales like intensely for 10 years and has never seen one. There's that to point to how rare they are.
I feel like it's like psychologically would like could spin you out if you let it.
Oh yeah. I think some of these people that I get to be out there and I've got a video camera, we're driving the boat and we get to see albatross and do these other things that are awesome. But these folks are like sitting with headphones on, listening to recordings, or maybe they're shipboard. So they're out on a research cruise like Jess Krantz gets to do, but she's in a like room on board the boat, not on deck, just listening for these whales. Like, mostly they're found using acoustics. But a quick point on, so that's how rare they are, that's like the extent people have to go to. Like, because of that rarity, there's some real big gaps in the science and what we know about them. And one of those things is we don't know where they go to breed and to calve. So we know where they are in the summer months, are the northern summer months, but we don't know where they are in the winter to do those things. We know some of them go to some of them kind of stay north, but they turn, enough of them turn up south, meaning Southern California, Baja, Central California, that we know that there's some sort of movement. And Dana's current work to get at what this movement is and where they go in the ocean is using samples of old baleen to analyze, I think, the nitrogen in it, to then tell you kind of what part of the ocean the whale was at the the baleen grows a little bit like tree rings, and it eventually renews itself. But so you can look at like a 5 year or 8 year, whatever period of that whale's life, and see from the nitrogen signature kind of where it was in the ocean, which is all kind of really cool, but also like, oh, if it's a humpback whale, you just follow that whale or right. satellite tag it or resight it. And that's just not an option with North Pacific right whales. So you have to like be super creative and resourceful just to answer some of these very basic questions. You can imagine that a whale that's one of the most endangered whales in the world, it would be pretty nice to know where they're going to calve, to know how we can offer them protections in that area or where they're going to breed. And like, let's, what if there's like a, you know, there's a lobster fishery there or something, or it's right in the middle of a shipping lane. You'd want to know that. And, and we don't.
It very demonstrably sounds like that's all stuff that needs to happen. But first, like this conversation started, need to know A, that they exist, and maybe from that point springboard into caring about the fact that they exist, and this film succeeds on both those levels. So I'm excited for you to get it out.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Justin. And thanks for, I feel like it is not Sea Doc's mission to care about North Pacific right whales, but I'm pretty proud of the fact that I've gotten everyone at Sea Doc to care about North Pacific right whales just through, I think, through my own interest. And we really appreciate the attention, and thank you for having me on, and thank you for hosting the screening, and we'll see you on Orcas. I'm quite looking forward to it. And I'm also looking forward to future episodes that don't include me, because I learn something new every time. Love this podcast.
Appreciate it. Well, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you, man.
See you in a few weeks at the screening.
Yeah, perfect.